The separation between science and human values is an illusion.
Where did we come from?
This is the first self-replicating species on the planet.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag Science Rising.
Hello and welcome to the Future Proof podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Coming up on this week's episode, an amazing tale of evolution. We'll be hearing the story of the newly discovered Crypt Keeper wasp. It'll totally gross you out. I'm looking forward to that. And could the answers to stopping tsunamis be turning the volume all the way up to 11? We'll explain more about that in a bit. If you'd like to contribute to the program, comments, we read out a lot of your comments and emails later on in the podcast, but get them into us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @newstalkscience. Before all that, as always, it's time to drift back in time and do to the week's science news. Strange mood this morning. A broadcaster and immunologist, Laura Dungan, joins me in studio, as does a broadcaster and physicist, Dr. Shane Berger. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Der Name deiner Mutter ist Margie.
Deine Antwort wurde als Ja.
Sorry about that. Our first story. Now, it was not, collaboration is not boring, but I guess I was looking for a bit of spice. I was hoping you'd say something mean. So that clip we heard is an amazing piece of audio. Can we hear it again, actually, Marianne?
Der Name deiner Mutter ist Margie.
Deine Antwort wurde als Ja.
So that is the sound of a woman, a young woman who's got locked-in syndrome, who can't move her eyes, listening to a sound and responding with the answer yes, Lara.
Yeah, the exact translation there is that your mother's name is, I think, Margit, and the computer responds, the answer given is yes. And this is new research that's come from Niels Birbaumer in the Weiss Centre in Geneva, and it was just published this week. And it's about individuals who have complete locked-in syndrome. So if you get a range of different diseases, but the most common people know of is ALS or motor neuron disease, what happens is you lose all your motor functions, and slowly that creeps its way up, and you start being able to breathe for yourself, and the last thing that you tend to lose is your eye movements. And it's called locked-in syndrome when you can still move your eyes, and then complete locked-in syndrome when you can no longer communicate. And there has been years and years of research trying to help these people to communicate, but there was a meta-analysis published not too long ago that's essentially shown that all of it doesn't work. So they use EEG, which is the kind of thing you use to look at seizures, and they've used a huge range of different things to try and see if it works. And this new research has used a thing called functional near infrared spectroscopy, measuring frontocentral oxygenation changes. What that means essentially is...
No, I'm pretty sure we're familiar with those terms.
Yeah, no, absolutely, you can move on.
Lara, I love you so much.
The way I'm like literally looking down reading it. What this means is that the front, everywhere in your brain, blood runs through it. And what they've somehow discovered, and they don't actually describe it in the paper how or why, it was from another paper, the amount of hemoglobin in your blood that's oxygenated and not oxygenated is different, and you can read this with a little light, infrared light. And they used this to decide if the person was saying yes or no depending on the oxygenation in the blood in their brain. And they asked them a load of questions that they know the answer to, and then obviously questions that they don't. And on average,
well, like a quiz.
Like a quiz, yeah, exactly. The capital of. And on average, for certainly for two of the patients, they got 80% accuracy, which is actually very good. For another patient, they got 75%, and for the other patient, it was around about 70%. And it's just really interesting because it's the first time it's worked. And they asked the patients facts that they already knew, and then they asked the patients about their quality of their life. Are they happy that they're alive? Now, it's slightly swayed because when people start to develop this paralysis, they're asked if they want to have a system fitted to breathe for them while they still can communicate. And all of these patients said yes, which means that they knew what was going to happen to them.
That said...
I know, look, and nobody knows what it's really going to be like. And yeah, and over 70% of the time, they said yes, they are happy.
They wanted to continue living.
And they wanted to continue
really
living the way they are, exactly.
Because
yeah,
it's one of those things that when we think about that that scenario, that you think, how on earth could someone live in that situation where they cannot move and cannot communicate? It's remarkable, and it says so much about the human spirit that these people wanted to continue.
They wanted to continue. Although one there was only one man of the four patients, and he's a 61-year-old man. He stopped communicating in August 2014. And they asked, his daughter asked him, can I have permission to marry my boyfriend Mario? And 9 times out of 10, he said no. So,
so they just keep trying.
So I suppose, yeah, just keep going. But he said, yeah, he said no to the marriage. But I don't know the background of it. I know.
Oh my God.
So maybe communication's not always good.
I like how they asked so many times. Like, maybe he's going to change his mind.
Yeah. Well, no, they asked every question 10 times.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Because you can't just ask once. So every question was asked 10 times. And you, as long as it was over 70 to 75%, you could take it as the right answer. But his was over 90%. Nope. Not happening, Mario. Walk away.
Oh, man. That's 61 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think my son would be quite good at that, asking 10 questions, the same exact same question.
Exactly.
53106 for 30 cents. You can also email us, science@newstalk.com. If you know someone who has been through this, we actually want to have a look at the science of it, and we also want to examine the whole process of someone who's in a deep state of coma or someone who has been in locked-in syndrome. If you have a family member, we would like to hear from you. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. Our second story has to do with hydrogen. And I was pretty sure when my researcher told me hydrogen was a metal that he was a bad researcher. I was like, no, it's not. Hydrogen is our lightest atom.
Element. So, element. But it is the lightest atom as well. So, yeah. An element, one atom of hydrogen. So,
how could it be? How could it be metal? But it can be.
It's the smallest element. It's number one on the periodic table. It's the most abundant element in the universe, and all the hydrogen that we have out there was created in the Big Bang. So, a lot of it out there. Our sun is comprised of hydrogen. Hydrogen, as we know it, we normally see it written down as H2. That means the two hydrogens like to stick together. So they are sort of that kind of the quintessential couple of we're better together. And perhaps in my analogy here of a good Catholic marriage, they're very hard to break apart. So they bond, and that bond is hard to break, right? And so, in fact, we've been wondering how we could break it for quite a long time. And it was predicted back in the 30s by physicists that if we could break apart the molecule of hydrogen into two individual atoms of hydrogen, that those atoms might be metallic in certain circumstances. And so that's what's happened. So they made this vice out of diamond. Doesn't that sound pretty cool? And in Harvard, and they, with massive pressures, like equivalent to the pressure at the center of the Earth, they have crushed and split apart these hydrogen molecules. And when they did that, they saw that the tiny hydrogen sample that they had, the atomic hydrogen, which is split, looked really different. It looked metallic, so it reflective, and so they were able to measure its reflectivity, and they have postulated that it's a metal. Now, this is very controversial, right? It's being dubbed the hydrogen wars in the science press at the moment, which I think is pretty cool. And so they
science press love attaching cool names to things, and then you read the story and you're like, actually not as cool as it represents.
So there are these are in Harvard, these guys, but there are people in Mainz in Germany and in Edinburgh in Scotland who are saying whilst the data is interesting, it doesn't necessarily show that it's a metal. They're basically saying early results looking positive, but there's an awful lot more to be done for this to be conclusively shown. But it's very, very interesting. If hydrogen metal, a solid metal, could be produced, then it might have very interesting properties. And when we as scientists make new materials, that's what gives us new applications. So the fact that your phone is so smart is due to the fact that it has things like a conductive screen or an amazing battery and all of those things. That comes about because scientists and chemists and physicists and people like that, they discover new materials.
Very good. Our third story has to do, it's actually quite sad in many ways. It's about how girls perceive themselves, even at a very young age, Laura.
Yeah, so this is based on two presuppositions. One is that there is a stereotype out there that men are better at things like maths, physics and philosophy. And the other presupposition is that maths, physics and philosophy are subjects that require brilliance. And they use this word over and over again, brilliance. I'm looking directly at Shane, who is a physicist. But it's this idea that these are subjects
he's
that require...
He's a bad physicist, though.
He can't have been that good. So these are subjects that require brilliance, and the presupposition is that men are better than them. And I think largely that stereotype is actually true. So What they did was, these researchers in New York University, Andre Siampin, he wanted to know when this was set up, because a lot of the research that happens around this happens with university level students. And he's like, okay, look, how far back do we have to go to find out what's going on? So he took about 400 children at the ages of 5, 6 and 7. And he asked them initially three questions. First of all, he told a story about a person who was really, really smart, because he says this is a child version of the words brilliance. He told a story about a person who's really, really smart. He showed pairs of photos of two people, either two women, a man and a woman, or two men, and said who is really, really smart. And he had picked objects like a hammer or attributes like really, really smart, and showed corresponding photos of men and women. So at the age of 5, children vastly pick their own gender as really, really smart. So the girls, a huge percentage of girls pick the women as really, really smart. A huge percentage of boys pick the men as really, really smart at 5. By 6, 1 year later, so 6 and 7 year olds, the percentage of boys who pick the boys as really, really smart is completely unchanged, still really high. The percentage of girls who pick girls as really, really smart has gone down hugely in the space of only 1 year. And they asked them to play games for people who were really, really smart, and other games for people who worked really, really hard. And the girls were happy to play the really, really hard games at the age of 6, but they didn't want to play the really, really smart games, whereas the boys were happy with the really, really smart games. So it's just very sad that within the space of a year, children have adopted this stereotype that's out there that is potentially going to mould the rest of their lives.
What's really worrying is that is the year in which they start school.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you wonder what else changes in a child's life. That is the time when they start getting formal education. The idea that a girl would not see themselves as, not want to take on these tasks.
But you know what was really
interesting? It's a correlation, but what else happens? You can text us in 53106 for 30 cent.
The one thing that was really interesting about it was they asked girls which other people in the class are going to get really good grades. And everyone said the girls. They had no problem at 6 and 7 saying, oh, the girls are going to get really good grades. But they associated that with hard work, not natural ability. So it's this idea that boys are smart because they were born smart. Girls are smart because they got to work hard. This is what they're kind of being taught.
Where was this? Where was it done, Lara?
New York and Illinois. Between,
so it's the US.
All in the US, yeah. And they admit that it was 75% white, all upper middle class children, and they know they need to expand that. But yes, all the
reason
US.
I ask is I know that this perception of boys being better at maths is particularly Western, and so in Eastern countries this perception doesn't exist, and as a consequence, girls do perform better than actually they do perform better than guys in most of our standard tests here in the West as well. Mm. But the perception doesn't go in the East.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good. Our final story has to do with posture. And it's something that every time I hear the word posture, it's kind of like when someone mentions like the teeth. You know, when someone says going to the dentist or that getting their teeth whitened or straightened, everyone closes their mouths, right? When I hear the word posture, I kind of go, oh, I'm learning it again. And I have a horrible feeling I'm going to have this hunchback when I'm 50 years old from leaning over a computer and, you know, I'm bending over the desk. So this is about posture and its effect on other things.
You're an interesting man, Jonathan. So slumped posture is actually a diagnostic feature of depression. That's well known.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So in what way?
So I believe that psychiatrists can tell by the gait of a person and their general posture their likelihood to be thus diagnosed like through further tests as depressive. So it is a known diagnostic tool. Now it's not the because only one, of course.
No, of course. Yeah. But you know what? I didn't realize that. But of course, I mean, of course, it's almost in a cartoonish and stereotypically way. You know, obvious if someone is drooping their shoulders and looking at their feet. You know, in cartoons and movies. You know, that's even in silent film, you can say, well, that person's obviously not feeling very well. Mm. But it's interesting that's actually used sort of as a diagnostic sort of visual check on people's.
Yeah, so doctors and scientists do tests and like to show these correlations. But it is sort of obvious, isn't it, when you think about it, that our body and our mind are going to be linked quite a lot. And you can tell when someone's in a good mood, like, you know, sitting up straight and just alert and kind of present, I suppose.
Wagging their tails.
Yeah, the human version of wagging your tail. So upright posture has also been known to improve self-esteem. So taking a power pose changes your brain chemistry, produces dopamine, and it produces thus a more sort of bombastic version of yourself. If you're going into an interview or giving a talk or coming on radio, Lara and I stand outside taking power poses
power
for
poses
a few seconds before we come in.
I thought the power pose thing, the chemicals thing was sort of up for grabs, but actually the that people's feelings feeling of confidence. That was definitely. But this
from what I'm told, it's associated with an increase in dopamine in the brain. So when you take that pose, So Ian Robertson in Trinity, I've heard him many times.
Yes, I have heard him say that. And so, actually, if you're smaller, you get an increase in cortisol.
Absolutely.
Stress hormone. So if you're sitting there and you're kind of making yourself small, you're more likely to.
Now, what's unsure, and I've asked Dean about it, is if you do this repeatedly, does the effect wear off? Like, so do you get the burst if you start doing it, like, briefly, you know, at the beginning, and then sort of your body cops on to this little trick that you're trying to play?
Oh, no, I'm on the radio with Jonathan again.
So this paper here from New Zealand looks at upright posture, and it shows that it improves effect and fatigue in people with depressive symptoms. And so they did this investigation where they asked people who had been diagnosed with depressive symptoms to take one of two postures. One, their normal slumped self, and people who are depressed do tend to have it more. And they asked another group then to sit up straight and to correct their posture, and they actually gave them instructions as to how to sit. And I can tell you Jonathan is now sitting bolt upright, and so am I actually. And so they showed that changes in effect and fatigue were how they were assessed, and they saw a correlation. They saw an effect with people, which is amazing. And so they measured it using standard tests to show how alert people were. One thing that was really interesting is they looked at the language that people used when they're being asked questions, and they stopped referring to themselves as much as people who had the slumped posture. And so this is associated with people who tend to be depressed, talk about themselves an awful lot, are very sort of self-obsessed. And that's not said in a negative way, that's just a symptom of depression. So it was incredible that self-focus reduced. Now, there are limitations to this. It's not a clinical study, it's just an early study, but it's very, very interesting, I think. It's the first time that we've looked at the effect of posture on people with depressive symptoms.
I've done the power pose thing. I did the Lie, the TV quiz show for the TV3. And when I'm training people on how to communicate in general, this is one of the things that I tell the story, because actually I was going out to do this show with this, like, a crew of 50 people. It was a big budget HD studio quiz show. I'd never done anything like it before. And I did the power pose because I'd just seen the TED Talk, and I was like, any sort of boost in confidence I could do with right now. And so I went out and went out in front of these people I'd never seen before, and you know, probably for the first time, absolutely nailed that first episode. And then after that, we went all downhill. And that's obviously where the study number of participants is one. When n equals one, it's not a very useful study.
You did something really interesting there, right? You took what other people might perceive as nerves and would put them off, and maybe you turned that into an excitement and ownership of the process. And that's a mark of successful people in those sorts of situations. I'm not trying to beat you up.
No. And actually, that's what you do have, because people sometimes when they're in a nervous situation, they start telling themselves they're no good, they're, you know, they can't do this, and they shouldn't be there. And we all have these voices in our head, but actually you absolutely do have to. I tell you this, every single person has this voice in their head sometimes when they're out of water, and you need to turn it into a positive thing. Shane, that's enough psycho babble. I'll say goodbye now before I get kicked off the show for lack of evidence. Dr. Shane Bergen, Dr. Lauren Dungan, thank you very much for coming on the program. In 2004, an earthquake created a devastating tsunami that killed 280,000 people and devastated thousands of miles of coastline. Was it a once-in-a-millennium event, as some had described it, or is there another one around the corner? And what could we do about it? Well, some scientists have suggested that the answer could be rock and roll. Brian McConnell is a senior geologist at the Geological Survey Ireland. He joins me now. Hi, Brian. How are you?
Hi, Jonathan.
I can't actually believe that it was that long ago, that it was 2004. It seems so present in my mind, that a devastating tsunami.
Indeed. Well, they were pretty striking images at the time, and we weren't familiar with that sort of thing or the potential of it. But I think since then, you know, the way global communications are, we're much more aware of the potential, and the images are transmitted around the world so much more easily. So, in fact, there have been a few, not quite as devastating, but a few similarly large tsunamis around the world since then. And so we get reminders every so often that this is a serious hazard.
Yeah, so it's funny you should say that, because I was thinking, before that tsunami hit, I guess
it just was not, the word was not in my head. And I think a lot of people would have no idea what a tsunami was. How common are these sort of enormous tsunamis, and where do they come from?
Well, for instance, since the 2004 one, we've had several tsunamis from similar size earthquakes around the coast of Chile, and obviously the big Japanese one in 2011, which brought it, refreshed our minds as to the scale, the potential of these things. They're caused by very large earthquakes on a certain type of boundary in the Earth's tectonic plates called subduction zones.
What are they?
Where one plate is being pushed down underneath another one. So that happens incrementally, and the stress builds up over years, and then it suddenly gets released with a large fault movement along a line of fracture, and the energy is released as an earthquake, and the Earth moves effectively. So when that is large enough, the displacement of the Earth's surface then can generate a displacement in the overlying water column, which then propagates as your tsunami wave.
So when that earthquake happens, above it, what happens? Is a wave created in all directions, or what's the physics of it?
It's created in all directions from the point of displacement of the water column. So as the ocean floor moves up as a result of the earthquake, that displaces the whole water column upwards. So then you can imagine a step of a few meters in the water column, that then has to equalize itself. So the wave radiates out, and it's a positive to start with. It's a positive wave in one direction, and a negative wave in the other direction. But just like
what's a negative wave?
Well, just a trough, you know, a low rather than a high wave crest. So if you imagine ripples on a pond when you drop in a stone, that there's a series of peaks and troughs, crests and troughs that radiate out from that. And a tsunami wave is something similar. It's not just one, and it's not just the upward part of the wave. It's a series of crests and troughs that radiate out.
And so why? Can you explain why over the vast distance of the ocean that doesn't just peter out? Like why a tsunami in the middle of the ocean would continue all the way out through the ocean? Obvious answer to that, but
it depends on how much energy is in the wave, which is related back to the size of the earthquake. But a lot of tsunamis do peter out as they radiate outwards. The energy dissipates, and the wave, by the time it gets to a coastline, may be negligible. But some of them have sufficient energy and if they're relatively close to a shoreline, then they still have plenty of energy to strike the coastline with a large wave.
Are we completely helpless against these sort of things? I mean, it seems like, you know, an entire wall of water that's miles and miles long, it sounds almost completely indefensible.
Yeah, we're not helpless in that we can do something to prepare. There are engineered solutions to the relatively small ones, like all around the coast of Japan. They have tsunami walls, which are engineered to reflect the energy from the tsunami away. And, for instance, the Fukushima power plant would have had one of those all around it to protect it from anticipated tsunamis. The problem was that the 2011 event was just larger than they had anticipated and engineered for. So it was breached by the wave.
If we can do walls, is that enough? Because there was a recent story in the paper where people had suggested that possibly we could use sound by putting speakers under the water to counteract the power of the wave. What do you make of that idea?
Well, it's an interesting idea. It's like meeting force with force and stopping it in its tracks, really. But the fact that it was published in a scientific journal suggests that theoretically, mathematically, it is sound as a theory. Now, whether it's possible in practice is a whole different matter. As the author said himself, the tricky bit is finding a way to engineer those waves of sufficient magnitude and in the right direction to do what he's proposing. It might be possible.
It's quite extraordinary as an idea that we could use speakers to create a wall of sound that would push back against a wave. But in terms of any defense, do we know where to put these things in an ocean, whether it's, you know, barriers or considering how vast the ocean is? Do we have a good idea from our studying where we should put them to prevent the next tsunami?
Well, we know which parts of the Earth are more prone to tsunamis. And again, going back to the Earth's tectonic plates, it's where these extra large earthquakes are created. And not all plate boundaries have the same potential for generating very large earthquakes. So, for instance, in our own case, we're in a relatively quiet tectonic situation on Earth, so we don't have those large subduction zones, as I call them, where one plate is being pushed down under the other, like they do all around the Pacific. We have relatively benign plate margins, and so we're not familiar with the extra large earthquakes and tsunamis that can result.
Yeah, when you think about Ireland, both geographically and geologically, and almost in every way, it's one of the probably best places to be situated in those sort of ways. It's really interesting speaking with you. Brian McConnell is Senior Geologist at the Geological Survey of Ireland. Now, due warning, this next subject is pretty... it's pretty macabre. I think most people find it pretty gross. If you are eating something right now, I don't think you should turn off the radio. I think you should just pause and listen to this story and then maybe resume eating a few hours later. Because it's to do with a certain type of parasite. And I've always been fascinated with parasites. And I know pretty much all of them by now, I think. But this one is particularly evil. A new parasite has been discovered by Dr. Kelly Wiener-Smith. She's at Rice University in the Biosciences Department. She joins us now. Hi, Kelly. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Before we start, do you mind awfully... I feel bad asking this, but Wiener-Smith as a surname is an unusual name in America, would it not be?
It's an unusual name, I think, across the world. In fact, I'm fairly certain that my husband and I are the only ones who have that last name and our children now, unfortunately for them. But my maiden name was Smith, and my husband's maiden name, pre-married name, was Wiener. And there were lots of Kelly Smiths and lots of Kelly Wieners who were publishing papers, and I couldn't find my own publications when I was searching by Kelly Smith. But if we put our names together, there's we're the only Wiener Smiths now. And so I took that horrible name to advance my career. And I think it's been working out for me, but my children will maybe not be too happy with me.
So in America, Wiener means Wiener and Smith, yeah. But Smith means to make things. So it's
indeed. And I just had a son. So
So it works. It works perfectly.
It does work. Indeed.
Well, congratulations on that. So tell us about this extraordinary species of wasp that you've found and take us through its life cycle.
Okay, so I will take you through its life cycle by going through the journey where we found this parasite. So my collaborator, Scott Egan, who's also at Rice University, cannot go anywhere without keeping his eyes on the trees and looking for galls. And galls are these growths on plants that are induced by insects, and they're induced by insects to benefit the insect in some way. So, for example, galls are often formed as a way to provide nutrition for developing wasps that are living inside of them, or as a way to protect those wasps from parasitoids. And he's obsessed with these in the best possible way. And he was on vacation.
Before you continue there, so this isn't like a nest. This is a process by which an insect can actually change the structure inside a plant?
Yeah, so these insects can be thought of as parasites of trees that manipulate something about the tree. And so they're manipulating the tree to get it to feed it and to protect it. And so these are parasites, essentially.
And so these galls are kind of like condominiums or apartments inside trees.
Exactly. And they can make various fancy forms of condominiums. But the ones that we study are pretty unfancy. So he noticed that on a live oak, there was a stem that was a little bit swollen. And that is indicative of the presence of the crypt gall wasp. And so the scientific name is Bisetia pallida. And so what the crypt gall wasp does is the female oviposits an egg into the stem, this newly developing stem, and it induces the formation of what's called a crypt, and which I just love that name, but it's a compartment that gets surrounded by this super nutritious tissue that the insect will eat as it develops. And if everything goes well for the crypt gall wasp, when they become adults, they excavate emergence holes and they leave the stem and they go off and do what gall wasps do with the rest of their adult lives. And so he was walking and talking with his daughter, and he saw this gall or this stem that was swollen, and he pulled it off the branch and stuck it in plastic bags, which he apparently always has in his pocket. And he brought it home and stuck it on his desk. And he noticed a couple months later that there were all these emergence holes, which is what you would expect for a crypt gall wasp. But additionally, there were a bunch of emergence holes that were smaller than usual, and they were plugged with the head of the crypt gall wasp. So it didn't get all the way out. Instead, it made this smaller hole, plugged it with its head, and died. And that seemed kind of weird to him. Hmm. And he had just seen my job talk about parasites that manipulate the behavior of their host so that the host does something that's good for the parasite but bad for itself. And so that made him wonder if maybe some weird manipulation was going on. So then dissections happened, and every time one of these heads was plugging a hole, or just about every time, inside of the crypt was also a parasitoid. So it looked like every time this weird behavior was happening, there was this parasitoid that no one had ever seen before in that crypt, also with the host.
Okay, so let's just slow it down for a second. Before we get to the really good bit, just to recap, you're talking about wasps who laid eggs inside stems of an oak that created sort of a cocoon where these eggs and larvae could eat, and then they burrow out. But in some of those holes, you found that their heads had been plugged into the hole rather than them getting out. That's where we are now. And inside those particular nests, you found a new type of parasite.
Yes. So there's the first parasite is the crypt gall wasp, and that's a parasite of the tree.
Yeah.
And then the second parasite in this system is a parasitoid that manipulates the gall wasp.
So when you say a parasitoid, what is that as opposed to a parasite?
So a parasitoid is a category of parasite where the parasite kills its host and needs to kill its host in order to survive. So in this case, what the parasitoid does is after it manipulates its host, it eats the inside of the host so that it can sustain itself through development and become an adult.
So tell us about, this is the new species that you've discovered. Tell us about it and its life cycle.
So, first of all, it's beautiful. It's these amazing iridescent colors. Depending on the angle that the light is coming from, it's blue or green or orange. Hmm. And it's quite tiny. And its colors are quite in contrast to the crypt gall wasp, which is just this drab brown. So you have this beautiful parasitoid. And maybe I'm biased as a parasitologist loving these parasitoids. But anyway, the female crypt keeper wasp, so that's the new name we gave it, the crypt keeper wasp, comes and lays an egg into the crypt with the developing wasp that was supposed to live there to begin with. And then it manipulates the host, the crypt gall wasp, into making an emergence hole and plugging it with its head. And then that host dies, and its internal organs are consumed by the developing parasitoid. And when the developing parasitoid becomes an adult, it eats its way through the head of the host and emerges through the host's head to go off and do what those parasitoids do in the next stage of their life cycle. So the manipulation is to make its host make a smaller emergence hole out of the crypt, plug it with its head, and then die so that its internal organs can be consumed. And as someone who's moderately claustrophobic, the idea of getting stuck in a tunnel where you can't turn around as you're attacked from the back is incredibly creepy, but incredibly cool because it's happening to insects and not to me.
This is sort of a Russian doll system that I haven't heard of before. Is it normal for wasps to be parasites on wasps?
It is, actually. So that's called hyperparasitism or hyperparasitoidism, but that doesn't roll off the tongue as well, so we usually just say hyperparasitism. But so it's pretty common for wasps to infect other wasps. But it's not necessarily common for the first wasp to manipulate something about its host. And in this case, the first wasp is manipulating trees. And for the second wasp to manipulate its host as well. So when you have two layers of manipulation like that, it's called hypermanipulation. And as far as we know, that is pretty rare. And so we're pretty excited to have found that.
It's like the Parasite version of Inception or something.
It is, yeah.
So can you explain how these parasites can control behavior? Because that's one of the questions that I've always had about zombie ants and all of these other amazing animals that are controlled in some way to the benefit of the parasite. How do we know about the mechanism of how that small wasp managed to get the larger wasp to stick his head in a hole and wait to be eaten from the inside out?
So that is an awesome question, and a question that we are trying to tackle next. In general, how parasites manipulate something about their host is a huge open question in the field that I work in. And in some cases, the answer seems to be pretty easy or pretty straightforward. For example, there's a caterpillar that dies at the top of trees and when it's infected by a virus, and then it liquefies and rains virus particles down on the caterpillars that are now down in the leaf litter below. And wow. That is, yeah, it's totally creepy and seems to be controlled by just one gene. And that was done by Kelly Hoover in 2011. And so that's a simple story. But the zombie ants that you mentioned, that's a much more complicated story, it looks like. So let me just quickly explain how the zombie ants work. So these are ants that live in rainforests, and they're infected by a fungus. And this fungus gets through their exoskeleton, so through their little hard-plated body parts, and gets into the inside of the ant. And the ant acts normal for a little while, but when the parasite is ready to start reproducing, it causes the ant to climb down out of the trees where these particular kinds of ants usually live. And they do this sort of drunkard's walk down the tree. And they end up on the forest floor, and they crawl along the forest floor. And then they find a sapling, and they climb up it about 20 centimeters, give or take 2.5 centimeters. I might be getting some of those numbers a little bit wrong, but the point is, it's very specific, which kind of blows my mind because I personally am a person who's not good at estimating distances. So the fact that a fungus can get an ant to go approximately 20 centimeters up by remote control is just amazing to me. And so if you take that leaf and you move it down a little bit, the fungus and the ant disappear because there are all these predators on the forest floor that can find that leaf easier when it's lower. And if you move that leaf up a little bit, then the temperature and humidity are wrong for the growth of the fungus, and the fungus dies and never gets a chance to reproduce. So it's important that it gets to specifically that area. And then it goes along the underside of a leaf, and it clamps, and the ant clamps its mouth parts down around the vein of the leaf and dies there. And then the fungus releases spores that rain down on the forest floor and infect more ants as they're going around looking for food. So it's amazing. And there are all of these steps in the process and all of these extra weird behaviors. And it always happens at like solar noon and on the northwest side of the plant. So it's incredibly precise and incredibly complicated. And it's done by a fungus. And like if you were to take these ants into the lab and give it to a neuroscientist and say, okay, ant brains are really easy. How is this done? Can you tell us how it's done and recreate it in the lab? The answer is no, we've been outsmarted by a fungus. Fungus understand ant brains better than we do. But before you feel too bad about that, there's fossil evidence that this interaction has been around for about 48 million years. So David Hughes has done a bunch of work in this study, and he was talking to someone who had a leaf fossil that had scars along the vein that match the scars that you see when the ants bite down around leaf veins. And so so there's fossil evidence that this interaction is 48 million years old. So the fungus has had at least that long through the process of natural selection to hone this procedure and figure out how to, you know, tinker with the ant's brain to manipulate it in this way. So Charissa De Becker has been working on that, and it looks like there's, you know, tons of different chemicals involved in that process, and they're all kind of changing at different steps in the manipulation. And a bunch of the genes that seem to be important are things that we've never identified before, and we don't even know what they do. So depending on the system, it seems like sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's complicated. We don't have a good framework yet for figuring out when the answer should be simple versus when it should be complicated. And in my system, we really have no idea what the answer is, but it could have something to do with manipulating the cues that the gall wasp usually uses to decide when it's time to emerge. So if there's some hormonal cue that tells it, okay, I'm an adult. Now I need to make that emergence hole and leave. Maybe the parasitoid has some way of manipulating that cue and getting them to have that cue later, or maybe to a lesser extent, and yeah. So it doesn't make a big enough hole.
I'm reading this book at the moment by Robert Cialdini, and it's called Persuasion. And in it, he's talking about sort of innate responses that some species have. So if you're colored a certain way, you'll be attacked. If you remove the color but have the same animal, the response won't be there. That if you smell a certain way, you'll be attacked. That's kind of what you're talking about, that there's probably things, whether it's a hormonal thing or a maturity thing or a gene expression thing, that these wasps decide, okay, now I need to change my behavior. And it's these cues that exist within these species that can be manipulated to get them to do what you want.
So I think that is most of the time true and is what's happening. But for example, with the zombie ants, the ants that are infected by that fungus, they do a series of behaviors that you don't see normal ants do. And so in that case, they're giving a brand new behavior. And so it's kind of harder to guess what cues should be used, because it's not like a flip or switch that you would expect could easily be flipped based on behaviors you've already seen the ant doing.
Right.
It's like a new suite of behaviors. And maybe that's why in that system, the answer is so complicated, because it's a brand new behavior, or appears to be a brand new behavior.
So back to the wasp, do you get to name a species when you find it? And how do you go about choosing a name for it?
Oh, heck yeah, you do. And that was really exciting, because we've never seen this parasitoid. It's never been described before. And so we were so excited, one, that it was so beautiful, and two, that it was new and doing this weird behavior, and three, that no one had described it before. So we got to do that. And so first, we proposed a common name, the Crypt Keeper Wasp, and we were pretty proud of ourselves for that one. But then we were able to determine that this parasitoid belongs in the genus Uterus, which makes me appreciate the parasitoid even more, because we now both have names that remind people of human reproductive organs. And so it's in the genus Uterus, and then we get to decide what its species name is. And my collaborator, Scott, did some reading about on Egyptology, and he noted that there was a god named Set, who was the god of evil and chaos. And one of the cool things about him was that he was able to control the behavior of evil beings. And since this is a parasitic manipulator controlling the behavior of another parasitic manipulator, we thought that that was sort of appropriate, and we were excited about that. But additionally, Set trapped his brother Osiris in a crypt, and we're working in a crypt, and he then scattered the remains of Osiris's body. And if you open up one of these crypts, scattered within the crypt is the body of the host after the parasitoid emerges. So in the process of emerging, the body parts of the host sort of get scattered around the crypt. So that also seemed like a very cool connection there. So we named it Uterus Set.
Uterus Set. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the character in a novel by Steinbeck. Uterus Set. That is an amazing story. And Kelly, it's been absolutely fantastic speaking with you.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. We must have you on again another time. That's Dr. Kelly Wienersmith. She's with Rice University and the discoverer of a new horrific type of wasp called Uterus Set. Parasites are awesome, aren't they? They are really, really fascinating. We've talked about them several times in the program over the past few years. If you're interested in hearing more, Ed Yong does a great talk on it. Just Google Ed Yong. Spelt exactly as you would imagine. He's a British journalist and gave a talk on parasites up on the internet. It's very entertaining. If you would like to contribute, as we said at the top of the podcast, you can email us science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. Some of your comments from last week. We were talking about this incredible idea of growing human organs inside of pigs. If you missed the podcast last week, you have to listen to it. It's both fascinating and disturbing. And as often happens on the podcast, people say, why are you not discussing the moral issues with this? For example, animal experimentation, growing human organs in animals, what that means to animals and what that means ethically for our society and so on and so forth. It's a really good question. And I guess the problem is that just to talk about the science takes enough time. We do talk about the ethics every once in a while, but if we talk about the ethics of animal testing every time we talk about new biological discoveries, then we would never have a podcast about anything except for ethics. And this isn't an ethics show, it's a science show. And so I get your concerns, and absolutely, I think
firstly, I think having to test on animals is really problematic for a number of reasons. People say that animals aren't harmed. They absolutely are harmed. People say that they follow strict regulations. We know that's not true in every lab. Often the benefits that you get out of them are questionable. Absolutely. All of these arguments are valid. And then on the flip side, you've got the argument that without testing on animals, we would never have gotten so many cures, even in the past decade. And I think that is also valid. And until we come up with a perfect replica of the human body in a on a chip, I think the ethics boards will grant the licenses to scientists to undergo these sort of or perform these sort of procedures. Any animal that suffers pain, it's horrific. And it's a tricky one, but it's almost, that's where the conversation ends. And we've had these conversations before, they go around in circles. So absolutely the ethics of almost anything on the program could be discussed in a separate side podcast, but I just don't have the time. Another says, hi there, the statement that no other animal on the planet cries is untrue. Coming from a farming background, if a cow feels pain, she cries. And we had a couple of texts in along this side, basically saying that cows do cry. One person actually says, I have seen, a Kerry farmer says, I have seen cows cry physical tears when calves have been taken away from them. And that is just a horrific mental picture, isn't it? That a mum has their child taken away from them at 6 months and the cow actually almost defies it, you know, the definition of crying and actually cries real tears because their calves. That's an awful. I don't know how you could continue to farm. And that's not a question on the character of that particular farmer. But seeing that, it's also screwed up the whole farming thing. This isn't an accusation of farming. It's, you know, how we get our meat. You have to stand up and say, I'm okay with this because otherwise you can't take a bite of a burger. But it's pretty screwed up the whole thing. I mean, ethics of everything is problematic. Kevin says, why as a teenager did I cry more whilst looking in the mirror and listening to the Smiths? Because I think hormones are at flux at that time. You may be experiencing hair in places you didn't ordinarily have hair, and I think obviously hormones they settle when we're a little bit older, and so that period we can be quite emotional depending on the trigger. Last week we also spoke about synthetic DNA and how researchers are using E. coli to basically create organisms that have six letters in their DNA, which is a mad story. Again, listen back to the podcast. The dude in the brick says, E. coli killed a lot of people. This is interesting, but sounds dangerous. Images of dinosaur-sized superbacteria. I would say least dangerous of all bacteria are the dinosaur size, because bacteria obviously need to be around about the cellular, much more than the cellular level to be effective. But don't worry about the E. coli bit. As we heard from our guest last week, these, because they need two other sources that aren't found in nature to create the X and the Y of the six-letter part of the DNA. This will make no sense to you if you didn't hear last week's show. But they can only be sustained artificially. They would not survive in the wild. So E. coli, not dangerous there. So last week, our guest on that six-letter DNA story was Mary O'Connell, and she said, you know, we're all made of DNA that has four letters naturally. And I said, even Trump, it was a cheap gag, I admit, but someone has texted in saying, nice of you to make that stab at Trump. However, he is stopping the funding of Planned Parenthood, who like to sell baby body parts. And they expect us to believe that DNA is the product of blind, meaningless chance mutations, yet each mutation towards the first steps of life was meaningful. That's not science. So, sorry about making a cheap stab at Trump. Absolutely low blow. He is stopping the funding of Planned Parenthood, who like to sell baby body parts. So he is stopping funding to organizations who also do abortions and provide information amongst their work. So America wasn't paying for abortions abroad anyway. They were paying for the work that organizations did, but not for the abortion. So he just spread it, which actually will cause countless deaths and horrible things to happen to women as a result. And that's a fact. They expect us to believe that DNA is the product of blind, meaningless chance mutations. Who are they? And that has been proven over and over and over and over that this is how DNA has come about. And you can watch a very simple video that shows you how chance and environment create the survival of the fittest to an environment. So you roll a dice 25,000 times and you're bound to get the right combination to a lock. And that is essentially how the entire thing works. That's how evolution works. So when you say that's not science, that is science. Kieran says, open a Pandora box, which is impressive because he didn't know that I was going to read out that text, but it's a completely appropriate text for what I've just said, but I've no idea what you're referring to when you just say open a Pandora box. But thanks for that, Kieran. And Pat Oranmore has a fitting end to this section of the podcast. He says, to paraphrase the inimitable Ian Malcolm, life finds a way. Indeed it does. Thanks for all of your comments. You can email us some more, scienceandnewstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. I'm almost certain we have stoked up some fire in your belly. And if we have, do get in touch. Researching this week was Ronan Braddock. Aoife Breen was producing. On sound was Marianne Kennedy. We'll be back next Saturday for more Future Proof. You can listen to the show live at 12 o'clock Irish time on a Saturday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof, proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. #ScienceRising.